Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. Museums are in the news. They've suddenly become very politicized and political institutions. As New York Times piece about leading museums having to remove native, so-called native, I'm using their language, displays amid new federal rules. The Biden administration apparently has updated their regulations in terms of what museums can and can't show associated with Native American tribes. And this in particular has resulted in the American Museum of Natural History having to close certain displays. So museums, some people might think, are outside politics, outside the news, but they're very much in it. And one man who's followed these cases very closely and has written a book about it is my guest today, Adam Cooper. He has a new book out, The Museum of Other People, From Colonial Acquisitions to Cosmopolitan Exhibitions. Adam is joining us from Cape Cod today. Adam, congratulations on the new book. Why have museums suddenly become so politicized? We all know, of course, about the various scandals and conflicts and disputes over the Elgin Marbles. Or have they always been controversial? Have they always been political?
They've always been political, not necessarily controversial, but they've always been political because they're about national identity and ideas of civilization and progress and all these kinds of issues which haunt Europe's and America's empires and imperial ambitions and sense of themselves. And they've also been the place in which local nationalist identities, minorities, have fought against this big narrative of universal civilizations and empires and stressed the need for recognition of particular identities which struggle to manage themselves and survive and broadcast to the world.
Adam, have museums, I look them up as we always do on Wikipedia, and the ones that come up tend to be from Western countries, the Louvre in Paris, for example. Have museums always been a feature of power? Have they always gone together with colonial powers, whether those powers were in antiquity, in Greece or Rome, or in modern Europe?
Well, they've always been part of the showcase of what the nation or the empire wants to represent itself as to the wider world. And the great museums really get going in the late 18th, early 19th century. And you find them in not only Paris, London, Berlin, but St. Petersburg. And then in the 1830s, they began to be built in the United States, particularly the Smithsonian, which is, of course, in Washington, D.C. It's part of the national, it's on the Mall in Washington, D.C. It's all around the Congress. It's part of the national self-presentation. Yes. And of course, for that reason, it's liable always to be dragged into politics, as you say, most recently by the Department of the Interior, whose director, Deb Haaland, who is an American Indian Native person, has said that for Native Americans to control exhibitions of their own artifacts is necessary in order, she says, to heal.
Do we have models? You've mentioned the Smithsonian, which is a fairly traditional one, and the Peabody Museum as well, another classic museum. But is the African-American Museum of History or Museum of African-American History in Washington, D.C., is that a model of a more modern, a more 21st century kind of representation?
Yes and no. It's an interesting museum. It is very much, it presents a narrative. So you start in the basement with images of the capture and deportation of slaves from West Africa to the Americas. And then you go up several levels through the history of slavery in the Americas, Civil War, the end of the abolition of slavery, and then in the 20th century, the development of national heroes in politics and sports and in the arts and so on. So it's a very uplifting narrative. But of course, it's very selective. So for example, in the original, in the bottom story, where the story begins in the basement, which is about the slaves and the slave ships carrying them to the Americas, there's no discussion of how the slaves got to the coast and were loaded onto the ships. But in fact, of course, they were brought there as a result of deals with major African kingdoms who were capturing slaves in order to sell them to the European traders. And that puts the whole story in a very different perspective. So now, if you want to take an instance of the politicization, which I find very interesting, there's an African-American nonprofit in New York City called the Restoration Study Group. And they have sued the Smithsonian for its attempt to send Benin bronzes, these wonderful African artworks, which the museum holds, to Nigeria, to the king, the heir to the kingdom of Benin, the Oba of Benin. And the Restoration Study Group said, look, our ancestors who were enslaved were sold in exchange for copper, which was the currency. And these coppers, some of these coppers, were used by the court smiths to make these Benin bronzes. So they were made in a way with the blood of our ancestors who were sold. So why give them back? They're now worth billions. Why give them back to the descendants of the people who enslaved us and sent our ancestors to this country? So the politicization of these objects is a very complicated story, often very interesting, very sad.
Yeah, I'm always struck, speaking of the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. I'm struck, firstly, by the beautiful building, the enormous amount of resources that have gone into it, and its geographical placement. Museums are central. Why are they so central? Why do we take them so seriously?
Well, they're central because school children are brought there to tell them, this is what you have to know of your own history. These are the wonderful things.
So it's official history. I mean, museums are about as official,
exactly,
manifestation of history as we get.
And it's also display. It says, look, be proud. Look at this.
And it's, or also be shamed. I mean, isn't the, yes, certainly the African American museum, the National Museum of African American History of Culture. I mean, that is a museum of shame in many ways.
It begins as a museum of tragedy and despair, but it's an uplifting story because as you go literally up through the museum, you go through the various stages of liberation of the African Americans and then their rise in American society. So it's an uplifting story which is presented there.
And museums are by, Adam, by definition, museums are dead, certainly dead history, whatever they might say. Does that suggest that once you get into a museum, you're no longer really relevant? You're simply being used by one group or other to make some point or other?
Well, why is that irrelevant if people are making points with what's in the museum and the stories that they
tell?
Because
people aren't really interested in you, whether you're a tribe or an individual or a piece of art. They're interested in what you signify.
Well, if you talk to people who go to the museums, they're going there for a lot of different reasons and they get different things out of them. And of course, they're different kinds of museums. Some are just seen as educational, like the various natural history museums, although they're also research institutions. Others are also regarded simply as treasure chests, as things like kings and aristocrats used to have in their country houses, the most beautiful paintings, the most fantastic sculptures, the most precious jewels. And people still love to go and see those things. They're very excited by them. And to be able to see some of the great works of art, the great works produced in the last 2,000-3,000 years, the greatest ones in the great museums, is for people who are interested in art, and most of us are one way or another, very exciting.
There have been attempts, or there are attempts these days, Adam, to bring museums, quote unquote, to life. As one Dali museum now that has incorporated AI, so you can actually talk to the great man, or at least talk to an AI version of him. What do you think of these new ways of making museums more interactive? I can imagine, and I'm sure there are some examples of being able to talk to slaves, people being transported over to America or somewhere else.
Yes, absolutely. I think the interaction ones and the play ones are very important for kids, because that's what they do all the time. In their spare time, they're playing all these games on their computers, and they come in and they can do that in the museum, but they also learn from it. But I think there's a bigger transformation coming to museums as a result of the magic of new technologies. So for example, there's a group in the engineering faculty at Oxford University in England, which has used lasers to operate on marble brought from the original quarries in Athens, from which the Parthenon was built, in order to make laser copies of Parthenon sculptures, which are absolutely perfect replicas. And so you ask yourself, okay, if I can put 10 of these wonderful Parthenon replicas in my sitting room, which one day is not going to cost a terrific amount of money, would I still want to go and see them in museums? If a little local museum has complete, perfectly copied replicas of all these great sculptures or works of pottery or whatever from elsewhere in the world, is that not sufficient? Is that going to change the idea of museums? Or do you really want to go and see the real thing, the magic thing? This was handled by George Washington. You can imagine yourself in George Washington's house. Is it Arlington? And go and see and hold and look at the things. He used this pen, he used this desk. I think there's a kind of magic still about the real thing. These are questions which are going to become important.
Yes. Well, we've always wondered about what Adam Cooper calls the real thing. One publication that addresses it is Friends at Liberty, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, going to run a short feature on liberties. And then we'll be back with Adam to talk more museums in 19th, 20th, and 21st century. So don't go away anywhere. We are not a museum.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Adam Cooper, the author of The Museum of Other People, a man who's dedicated his life in many ways to the Museum of Other People. He is an anthropologist, very distinguished, taught at London School of Economics, many other places. Adam, do you remember the first time you went to a museum?
Oh, my goodness. I think I went to a museum, must have been in South Africa as a child. I think so, yes.
How you grew up in South Africa and yes. Apartheid South Africa. How was Black Africa represented in the white apartheid South Africa in museum terms?
It was regarded as the best is long ago. So the past was beautiful and romantic and colorful and so on and so forth, and that's over. And now the people of South Africa are all working in a, of course, different levels and with a lot of discrimination, but in a single modern economy and so on and so forth. So the idea was, this is all very much in the past. It's sort of almost ancient history. And of course, the reason I went into anthropology was because growing up in apartheid South Africa was a living challenge as I was growing up, to the idea of how do you understand people who are being excluded, who are persecuted, who are discriminated against? How can we enter into some kind of sympathetic understanding of the life they led? And when I did my first degree at university, I became involved in politics and so on, and I became persona non grata in the country, and I was refused permission to do research in South Africa. So for my PhD, my doctoral research, I did research in the neighboring British colony, what was then the Bechuanaland Protectorate, living for 2 years in a mud hut in the Kalahari Desert, as much as possible, living the lives within an African village and trying to understand and sympathize with and participate in the life that they led. So it was this experience of growing up in South Africa which made me into an anthropologist.
Adam, you got 3 kids, I got a couple. I was found taking kids to museums to be one of the best kind of parental bonding experiences. Did you go with your parents? Did you take your kids? What advice would you give parents with young children, given the cultural and political minefields which museums supposedly now represent? Should parents have that talk to their kids before they take them to the colonial museum, anthropological museum in Brussels or New York or London?
Yes, it's a very good question, Andrew. A lot of it depends on your kids, what their interests are, or the kind of thing that sparks them. Because you have to find a point of contact between their interests and their understanding of the world and what they're going to see, and therefore which museum you go to. So one of my grandchildren, for example, is absolutely fascinated by geology. And he's got a little collection of strange rocks and precious stones and so on. And so he loves being taken to a museum where he can see geological collections, which I'll put in context. Other kids draw or interested in art or think about these things. Others are developing some sort of interest in history. You've got to find a point of contact between something that interests them and what you can show them in a museum, and then use this to extend their range and open new possibilities to them.
Your son was on the show a couple of times, Simon Cooper, a very distinguished writer, particularly on football. I'm guessing you dragged him to too many museums, Adam, when he was younger, and he wanted to go to the football match instead.
Yeah, when he was growing up, we were living in Holland mostly when he was a boy.
Well, that's where, if you live in Holland, you got to go to the football rather than museums, although the art museums are pretty good.
You can go to both. It's not necessarily, there's a choice. So we used to drag them around the museums a lot. And there was a certain amount of resistance, but occasionally you were able to make a connection. It's not only museums, old buildings, old churches, historical monuments of various kinds, places where famous people lived. I mean, one of the most moving museums in Amsterdam is the Anne Frank House, which is a museum which is wonderful for children because it's about a young girl hiding from the Nazis during the occupation, the German occupation of Holland. And you're very much immersed in her experience. There are all sorts of clues as to what was happening. You're looking at the little rooms, the bits of videos and so on. And all three of my children have taken their own children back several times visiting Holland to go to that museum.
Although I know some people in Amsterdam don't much care for that particular museum, partly I think because there are so many people. It's always so crowded and it creates all these lines of people and adds to the touristic nature of Amsterdam, but also perhaps because it creates a kind of almost Disneyfied narrative of Anne Frank, which may or may not be true.
I would push back against that. I think it's a very honest and insightful account, which they continually renew. It's as more and more, you know, new generations are visiting the museum, visiting the house, the different kinds of presentations are necessary, different kinds of...
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I mean, speaking of the Holocaust, dead history, the history of death, Facebook's been in the news. Auschwitz Museum, their Facebook page got flagged because they had images of death camp victims, which of course reflects the absurdity of Facebook. Meanwhile, I'm not sure if you saw the Jonathan Glazer's Oscar-winning movie, The Zone of Interest, which is adapted from Martin Amis's book. Yeah. It's a book about the death camps seen from the perspective of the camp commandant and his family. And it ends in the Auschwitz Museum. And I'm not entirely sure what Glazer's point was, but perhaps everything ends in a museum, even death. I don't know what you think about that. I mean, what's your sense of how museums of such enormous criminality like the Nazi death camps, how should they be represented and how do they fit in to your arguments in the Museum of Other People?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. I mean, you have several museums which are dedicated to a single terrifically important historical event, and of course Auschwitz Museum is one particular example. You have some museums of great historical battles or other sorts of events. I think of the best way to think of museums of that kind is often as a mixture of a destination and an evocation. So it's very important that these museums are in the place where the event happened.
Mm.
So there's a sense when you're visiting it that you are immersing yourself in the history of a place which is still there and which you can relate to, and it helps you to understand what happened and also helps you to come to terms with some sort of understanding of the place. You can't just look at it and move out as you would if it was in one room in a big museum. You're immersed in a larger experience, which makes it very powerful sometimes, yes.
Adam, can museums ever be truly independent? When I think of the recent news of the American Museum of Natural History closing certain displays because of new federal regulations, which perhaps reflect more respect for Native Americans, does that reflect different power balances? And the idea of museums ever being truthful or neutral is inconceivable, is absurd. That they simply reflect the way we're thinking about colonialism or racism or the history of slavery or the American genocide of Native Americans or any other narrative in a country's history.
I mean, there's something there. I mean, first of all, 90% of museums are not controversial in that sort of way. If I've got a museum of geology or a museum of skeletons of different kinds of animals and so on and so forth, the Natural History Museum in Paris, which shows you the relationship between different animals which have died out and living animals and so on and so forth. There's nothing political about that. Lots of museums have that kind of story. The same is true of many art museums, museums of modern art or museums of classical art or Renaissance art. They can be used in a political way, but usually aren't. So it's, when we're talking about these political museums, these are museums about identities, about representations of particular kinds of history. And I think that just like with any other kind of history, there can be more and less objective stories told. And I am in favor of stories or accounts which are informed by the latest historical scholarship and which, as far as possible, refer to political controversies relating to these histories, but don't take strong sides between this one or that one. They try to present something which people can argue about when it's there, but they can't argue about really about the truth of the representation. It's the meaning of the representation which might be up for grabs. But what's happening today is that instead of the museums trying to represent grand national political accounts often and being criticized by conservatives if it's not making the national history glorious, sufficiently glorious, now the politicization is often really from minority groups, which are saying, we have the right to decide how we are going to be represented in your museums, your national museums. And that's really the most sensitive kind of debates that are going on at the moment. And the story of the closure of some Native American exhibitions and some of the great American museums, like the Museum of Natural History in New York or in the Smithsonian, other museums around the country. This is an initiative by the Department of the Interior, which makes it very interesting because it's actually a government department intervening and saying to museums, look, you can't exhibit Native American artifacts without the permission of the tribe or some kind of spokespeople of the people who are being represented. You can't do it. You can only do it also if they agree with the representation that you are presenting. And if there's any dispute between what your scholars or archaeologists or anthropologists are saying and what this particular native tribe wants to say, then you have to go with the native tribe's decision. So the result is that a lot of these great museums, including, as you say, the Museum of Natural History in New York, are simply closing these exhibitions. So Deb Haaland, the director of the Department of Interior, brought these new regulations in this January. And the immediate effect has been the shuttering of exhibitions of Native American artifacts and some of the great American...
So are you arguing against that? You think it's slightly absurd?
I think it's completely absurd. I think it is completely ridiculous. Now, I mean, let me give you an example. In the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the Willamette meteorite. So this is the oldest and largest meteorite to be discovered in the United States. It was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century. It was bought by the Museum of Natural History. And a few years ago, they reopened a special gallery in which this was the great exhibit in the middle. And a tribal federation on the West Coast, near where the meteorite was discovered, says, wait a minute. This meteorite was sent to Earth by our ancestors to help us, and we should be presenting all sorts of ceremonials around it, which should dance around it. And it should be explained. If you're going to show it, you've got to explain that this was sent by our ancestors out of the sky. So the meteorite is now there in the middle of this room. And it has two big labels, one on each side. The one explains the meteorite from the point of view of astrophysics. And the other gives the explanation of this particular group, or at least the alleged explanation of this particular group, that it was sent by their ancestors. Well, is that a reasonable kind of compromise? Or if Deb Haaland at the Department of Interior gets away, would you only have to say, this was sent by the ancestors of this particular tribe, without mentioning what the astrophysicists might say about it?
Yeah, it's a very interesting debate, and I think it connects with a lot of the other debates in America about cultural representations, what people should and shouldn't see. I mean, of course, there are conservatives who want kids not to read certain books. Are conservatives, Deb Haaland is more on the progressive side. Are the conservatives wanting to simply shut some of these some of these museums down, whether it's in Florida or Texas or elsewhere?
Not so much they want to close them down, but they want them to shape the representations in this country of aspects of American history and messages about American history in a way which suits them, in a way which they think is feeds a decent pride in American history and people who come to the museum. So there is a certain amount of pressure to do that. There may be cases, I'm not aware of any cases in which exhibits have really been closed down or forced completely to reassign themselves to in the way you suggest.
And some of the new museums I find in America are actually excellent. Recently I was at the museum in Jackson, Mississippi on slavery and the African-American experience. I thought that was excellent. I'm not sure if you've been there. Finally, Adam, you mentioned you grew up in South Africa. Many people now go to Africa, not so much to look at prehistoric civilizations, but to look at nature, to do the safari, which is a kind of museum too. What are your thoughts on that and the way in which nature is being represented? Of course, nature doesn't have a voice. We can't talk to the lions and the elephants. Most of them seem to have been destroyed anyway. Is this issue of how we represent nature, is this becoming part of the debate about museums, not just the museum of other people, but the museum of other species?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a very good point. It's interesting. If you, at the moment, the same time as museums were being set up in Europe, so were gardens of tropical medicine, tropical medicines, plant medicines, and also plant varieties. So that was, you had the British Museum in London, but you also had Kew Gardens, which was a living museum of plants and so forth from all over the world. And then you also had the London Zoo, which was a living museum on creatures all around the world. So these were all representations. And of course, there were big arguments about the way in which zoos represent animal lives and animal varieties and so on. Less controversy about plants. But yes, this was all part of the powerful nations of Europe and North America representing the world, showing the variety, the differences, the places, the wonders of the world to people who didn't have easy access to travel and didn't have television and didn't have documentary films and so forth. But we're curious, what is the world like, the greater world around us? What is it like? And travelers and so on, missionaries, later colonial officers, would bring back stuff to show them. And these were all, in their different ways, museums of the world.
So it's no coincidence that you can walk from the London Zoo to the Great Museums of London, or from the Berlin Zoo, which is a wonderful zoo in the middle of Berlin, to some of the great museums in Berlin.
Yes, yes. It's part of the same architecture, city architecture, in the great cities of Europe and North America. Yes.